why. We make our own rules here. So we're going to get started a little bit early. Welcome. My name is Chelsea Baugh, and I look after internal and corporate communications at RetailMeNot. And I'm really honored to be here today alongside these ladies and really pleased to be at the conference this year to learn from and support this community. RetailMeNot is committed to diversity, inclusion, and equity, and we are so proud to be a repeat corporate sponsor of the Texas Conference for Women. We have about 50 of our employees here today on behalf of our women's employee resource group, and we've spent the last year together focusing on strengthening our network and then developing the skills to really succeed in the workplace. And the resources put forth by these ladies are invaluable to that journey. So, again, thank you all for joining us this morning for the Managing Up panel. I am thrilled to now introduce Mary Abajay, president of CareerStone Group and author of Managing Up. You can find this in the bookstore. And she has a book signing directly after this. She also has extensive experience in developing talent and helping individuals assess their workplace style to best handle any type of boss. So please welcome Mary Abajay.
Thank you. Am I on, Hondo? Can we hear for the AV guy whose name is really Hondo? Big round of applause for Hondo. Hey, how many of you are from Texas? Nice. This is my first time to Austin. I gotta say, you got a pretty nice city here. Awesome. All right, how many of you have a boss? How many of you have a boss that you like? How many of you have a boss that's like, meh? How many of you have a boss who's a total living nightmare? How many of you can't say because your boss is in the room? How many of you are a boss? Great. So what we're going to talk about today is we're going to talk about the importance of managing up. All right, and we're going to do a couple things today. We're going to talk about what it is, so we're going to be really clear what it is. We're going to talk about why we all need to do it, and then we're going to talk about how to do it. I have an amazing panel here next to me. I have Alice Rutkowski. I have Lori Rudiman. Did I say that right? Rudiman. Rudiman. Oh, I practice all day. And I have Chrissy. No, she's made Schumann. I had that already. All right. Chrissy Schumann, Lori Rudiman, and Alice Walkowski. I'm going to give them a better introduction in a moment, but first I'm going to just give you a little bit as the thought leader. I'm going to give you about a 10-minute sort of download on what managing up is and what it isn't. Okay? So what is managing up? Managing up, I'll tell you what it isn't. Managing up is not sucking up, right? It is not brown-nosing or boot-licking or butt-kissing or being a sycophant, right? That is not what managing up is. Managing up is about managing the relationship with your boss, with the people who are higher up in the food chain than us, right, in order to get great results for you, for them, and for the organization. So it's a threefer, right? It's a threefer. It's about relationships. And why it's important is because the work world is a social system. Am I right? It's a social system, which means that we have to get work done with, through, sometimes around other people, right? And in a social system, relationships matter. They matter a lot. The relationships with your peers matter, with your colleagues, with your teammates, with your clients, with your customers. Those relationships matter. The relationships with the people that work for you matter, right? Those matter. And perhaps one of the most important relationships for your career is that with your boss. Our bosses, whether we like it or not, have a tremendous amount of influence over our career trajectory. They get a lot of say in the kinds of projects we get to work on. They get a lot of say in the types of teams we get to be on. They have a lot of influence over our visibility in the company and in our industry. So that's reason number one. Reason number two is that your career matters. Each and every one of us in this room has to take responsibility for driving our own career, right? Our careers matter to us. If they don't matter to us, who are they going to matter to? How many people care about their career? Thank you. The third reason we have to manage up is as much as we would love it to be true, we cannot change other people, right? All we can do is either request a different behavior or we can adapt our behavior. So when we are talking about managing relationships, what we're talking about is having high relationship intelligence. We're talking about figuring out who we are working for, how they like to operate, and how we can adapt to that and not resist it, right? Now, we have to talk a little bit about the truth about bosses, okay? 75% of U.S. workers say their boss is the worst part of their day. 75% of people, worst part of their day. 57% of people say that their boss is either mildly or highly toxic. I mean, I've ever had a toxic boss, right? By the way, when you have a toxic boss, you have to get out. They're not changing, right? One of the top three reasons people leave organizations is because of the relationship with their boss, right? So this is really important. Now, how do bosses become bosses, people? How are they promoted? Based on their boss skills? No. They're often promoted based on their technical aptitude of the job they're currently doing, not on their managerial aptitude. So what this means is in our career, we are going to have a spectrum of bosses. On the one end, we're going to have bosses who are amazing, easy peasy, lemon squeezy. Who's had a boss like that? They're great, right? You don't have to do anything, right? You just show up and be you. You're valued, and they find you valuable. There's no managing up there. There's just being happy. How many of you actually have a boss like that right now? Okay, so everyone hates you right now, just to be clear. Look around there. Then on the farther other end of the spectrum, you're going to have bosses that are a true living nightmare. The toxic, psycho, truly terrible, tyrant, bully, screamer, shouters, narcissist, right? Has anyone ever had one of those? Right. They're great, aren't they? So if you have one of those, there's actually not a lot of managing up you can do either. What you have to do when you have this kind of boss is you have to survive until you can get out. There is no thriving under this types of boss. And there's actually a lot of research, which we won't go into now, but you can read my article on HBR, about the damaging effects it has on you to stay with this boss. But in the middle are all kinds of bosses, right? And in the middle is where managing up is. So here's how you do it. Number one, you have to take a look at who your boss really is. Not who you wish they were, not who they need to be, not who they ought to be, but who they really are. How do they like to work? What's their communication style? What are their priorities? Are they independent? Are they collaborative? Are they detail-oriented? Are they big picture? Do they like the written word? Do they like the verbal word? Are they introvert? Are they extrovert? Do they like quick results or high quality? Do they want to see your butt in that seat every day? Or do they not give a shit if you show up as long as you get the work done, right? You've got to really understand who they are and what drives them. Second thing you have to do is you have to take a good look at who you are, who you really are, not who you think you are. How many of you think you have a pretty high self-awareness of who you are? Stand up. If you think you're really high in self-awareness, please stand up. All right. Now, if you think that if I went and surveyed the people that work with you, if they would have the same opinion of you that you have yourself, remain standing. The rest of you sit down. All right, for those of you who are standing, how many of you would bet your 401k on it? So Tasha Yurick did, go ahead and sit down. Tasha Yurick did this great book about called Insight, and she studied knowledge workers and said that 95% of people think they have self-awareness. When she then went and tested the people around them, do you know what percentage of those people actually were aware about their impact? 15%. 15%. So once you really figure out who you are and who your manager is, then you get to assess the gap. How are you different? How are you same? What can you do more of? What can you do less of? What can you do differently in order to close that gap? Because we can't change other people. Now, I am not talking about bosses who are unethical. I'm not talking about anyone who abuses you in any way. I'm talking about normal bosses that are just a little hard to work for. That is what you do. Figure out who they are, and you are always in choice. So here's the thing. When you're finding yourself in that kind of situation, you have three choices. This is from Eckhart Tolle. Choice number one is you can change it, right? Well, since you can't change other people, you could request a different behavior. You can go to HR. Good luck with that, right? Right? That's one option. Or you can accept it. And by accepting the situation, we adapt to it. Like, how can we adapt to make this good for us, for them, and the organization? And the third choice you have is to leave it, which means get a different job or a different boss. And that's a choice that we often have to make and shouldn't be afraid to make it. The choice that I don't want anyone in this room to make is the no choice, where you sit there and you become bitter because your boss sucks, right? Then we become a career victim. And once we're in that mode, when our reptile brain, our amygdala takes charge of us, we are no longer making strategic choices. So I want you, whatever you choose to do, I am fine, just choose. I want you to be, because choosing will make you a career victor and not a career victim. Got it? All right, you guys ready for the panel?
Yeah.
All right, awesome. So let me, I'm going to read their inductions because they're so amazing. All right, so Christy Schumann, I'm the last. Christy is a general manager for Rackspace Managed Security, and in her role, she leads product, service delivery, engineering. Do you work with a bunch of guys?
I do.
Awesome.
I mean, Rackspace in the house, I think we all work with a bunch of guys.
Are there any Rackspaces? Woo, you guys, you should stand up and give her applause. Get up there, stand. I'm taking note about who didn't suck up to you. No. Schumann's, Christy's career spans more than a decade of experience in management consulting from Bain & Company, along with business operations and strategic planning and technology with Rackspace. Combining her knowledge of the technical industry along with the strategic planning, Schumann was instrumental in developing the Managed Pivotal Cloud Foundry. I don't even know what that is.
I know, it's okay.
It sounds really impressive. which is Rackspace's first managed platform solution that allows enterprises to quickly build and deploy applications at scale. How many of you are in technology and actually understood that? Great. All right. And by the way, I met Christy last night. Not only is she highly accomplished, she's super nice and kind of fun, too. So she's my new BFF.
Kind of.
Right here to the left is an amazing woman, Alice Rutkowski. She is the vice president at Sagan, where she serves nationally as an executive communications coach. Alice joined Sagan with more than 30 years of experience in both the corporate world and consulting project practices. She is known for specialized nonverbal communication coaching that sets her apart in the field of executive communications. I'm telling you what she does. She's a body expert. She is a body language expert. And I was picking her brain last night on the bus, and I am like, I am going to be on her like crazy. Like, she is, I'm not even going to read the rest of this because you're okay. So amazing. Like, she can, you'll walk for her, or she'll tell you exactly what you are.
Oh.
And where you're, and like, and how much money you make, and how many children you have, and like, she is amazing. She doesn't just do that like this. I mean, she goes deep. It is really fascinating. Alice, I'm so excited to meet you. And finally, the amazing Lori Ruderman, who is a former human resource leader turned writer, speaker, entrepreneur, who is known for her common sense style and straightforward approach to workplace issues. She has been featured on NPR, The New Yorker, Vox, and CNN. Just tiny media.
I'm so fancy.
Just tiny media.
Great.
Tiny. She's the creator of The Cynical Girl, and this is my total favorite, Punk Rock HR, and is the editor for the Conference Board Review, which, by the way, if you guys don't know the Conference Board, it's huge, and a contributor to online ventures such as Media Bistro, AOL, and Business Insider. She's been featured in CIO Magazine, Entrepreneur, Fast Company, again, all these tiny publications.
I know.
Men's Health, Real Simple, New York Times, U.S. News and World Report, USA Today, Wall Street Journal, and Career Builder, CNN.com. And she keynotes all over the world. So please help me welcome Lori Ruderman.
Hi, guys. Hey, y'all.
All right. So where shall we start? I'm going to go with Christy on this one. So one of the most important things that I think about in terms of understanding how to manage up is understanding the person. And Christy was talking to me about how she has learned about understanding bosses' intrinsic drivers. So, Christy, tell us what that means. What do you look for? How do you find out? And then what do you do with that information?
Do we have any management consultants here? Some? Any? Zero. Ex-management consultants? Okay. I feel like, at least in Bain land and in management consulting, there's a lot of formal training about MBTI. For Rackspace, we have Gallup Strengths. There's always something that gives you a view into what those intrinsic drivers are about your boss, how they operate, all those things that Mary listed, even things that introverted, extroverted, obvious, but there are things, are they want to dive down deep in the data? Do they want to always stay high level? Are they a night person or a morning person? Do they like text or do they like email? All of these things. In Bain, we focus on MBTI, and there's that 16 quadrants. And depending on which quadrant you fall into and which quadrant your boss falls into, I feel like there's this Venn diagram of optimal happiness, where if you act one way, they'll be super happy. And when they're happy, you're happy. I think it's just very important to know what drives them, because it will create a very efficient, optimal environment for both of you to operate in.
And so once you know, Christy, like, just drop the truth bomb. Once you know what they are, what do we need to do?
I think you need to frame everything you do to match their drivers, to match their priorities. You have to adapt. You have to be flexible. And I think what Mary says very clearly in her book is that you have to adapt to them and you have to change, because the likelihood is that they won't. And so I will talk about it, but I still have trouble and day in, day out, actually executing on what I know I'm supposed to do, because I have certain propensities in the way I act and the way I speak, and changing myself on a daily basis to match them is hard.
And so, you know, the thing you want to think about is how many of you are bosses again? All right, so what I want you to be thinking about during this is, are you making it easy for your boss to, for your people to manage up to you, right? You, when you have one boss, Christy, how many people do you have reporting to you?
Four.
Four. And so, yes, we should. I have like four people too. We should adapt to you. But sometimes it's hard. And so the adapting is really important. And so I want to ask Lori, because you're HR, like, gets in the way? Like, why don't people understand this?
Well, a couple things. Number one, people don't realize that they are the chief relationship officers of their own lives. So we think we're accountants or project managers or finance experts. No, you are a human being, and your job is to have a relationship first and foremost. So the second thing is that work is fundamentally unfair, and it is structured against you. And I know this. I worked in human resources, right? Fundamentally, you do not have any power. So the way you reclaim power is by trying to understand that you have boundaries, that you have dignity, and within that realm, if you can have relationships that are satisfying, do it. But to Mary's point, there are some instances at work that are just going to suck forever, and you have to make a decision. Is this consistent with my values or not?
I love you. That's awesome. All right. I love all these women. All right. So, Alice. So, Alice does body language. So, Alice, tell us a little bit about what we should be looking for in the body language, and how, in both in terms of what to look for in the boss, and what we should be looking for in our own body language. Hmm.
Okay, so let's say you're with your family, your friends, your clan, your tribe, whatever. You're at a gathering. You're going to just do whatever, right? You're accepted because they're not going to judge you. They're not going to go, hey, you know, Alice, that body language. You do what you do. All your habits come out, and they're accepted. Your boss is generally not your peep, not your friend, right? Not your clan, not your family, usually. So that means there's a whole different standard around what's going on physically. Because this, in all seriousness, or this that I see very often with women, see the foot action down here? That generally doesn't work. So here are a couple of my hints. The first is start to learn your own body language. You cannot read somebody else unless you read your own. Take a class. Ask a friend, how did I do in that meeting? What's going on physically for you? Because frankly, some people say it's 60%. You know what I say? It's 100%. Your body emits your values, your attitudes, your spirit that day, your comfort, your discomfort. It's all in here, right? And the body doesn't lie. So first, learn your own. Second, become a Sherlock with your boss. Observe. Observe. Every day you're with them, observe. What are you observing if it's nonverbal? Because you're definitely listening. But what are you observing if it's nonverbal? How fast they move? How slow they move? Do they like to sit? Do they like to stand? Do they want you to sit? Do they sit next to you? Do they sit a mile away from you? Everybody in your chairs, would you lean back, please? Everybody lean back. Wow. Does your boss sit like that? Go back further. Hands on the head. Back here. Let's try that. Everybody, hands back here.
I'll do it.
Lean back. Whoa, look at the room. That's amazing. Okay, now come to center. Now come slightly forward. You're interested in me. Wow. I'm going to eat that up. That's like, I am right here. So how does your boss move, right? Observing. And if you're not calm, by the way, it's really hard to observe. If I'm like this, and I'm nervous about a meeting I'm having, and, you know, all my energy is up, which is where the stress is in the body. Relaxation is down. Stress is up. How in the heck am I going to observe somebody? I'm just concerned about what I'm saying. I always like to say this. I said it this morning. Chill out before you go into a meeting, because you'll be a much better observer. Your processing is much better. Your eyes see more. I'm going to watch. So one is you. Two is the other. What are they doing? How fast do they talk? How well are they with silence and stillness? All those things help you. Now, how about mirroring? That's another thing. I learn about me. I learn about you. Now I'm going to mirror a little bit. So what happens if imagine I'm sitting next to you and I come forward. I'm your boss. What are you going to do? I'm coming forward.
Come forward.
Yeah. Mirror me. Come forward toward me. Okay, now I'm going to go back a little bit. I'm going to go back. We actually do this. A lot of the times we do it naturally, but not always. You know why? Because we're not conscious. We're really not conscious physically. That means physical fitness is great. You're in touch with your heartbeat and everything. But this is a whole different study. It's a huge study. It'll take your lifetime to figure it out. So those are my three things is learn your own, learn the other, mirror, and come from a neutral position when in doubt. So I'm going to ask you, it's okay? I'm going to ask you all stand, please. Because it's body language, right? Yeah. We have to move
a little bit.
Yeah, of course.
All right. Put your feet together. I could knock you all over right now. If I started right there, you'd all hit each other like this. Why? Because you're not centered. You want to be centered in your lower body, standing or sitting. Do you know where your coccyx bone is? This is really an important one. I know it's going to seem weird to you. Your coccyx bone is at the bottom of your spine. I want you to imagine you have a tail there. Can you get a tail? Big tail. Lion's tail, not a mouse tail. Got it? Okay, close your eyes for a second. One, two, three, drop down. In, drop the tail down. Tail, tail, tail. Ooh, great. Okay, now you're centered. You're more relaxed. Ready? Except, you can open your eyes now. Except, if you go with that, what's going to happen? Let's do it. Ooh, I'm going to be like really depressed looking, right? This does not help your meeting, so come on up. Up in the chest. Imagine you have a zipper. Zipper goes up. Wow. Look at that stance in this room. That's the center place. You know, remember, I don't know if you had this, but I was a kid a long time ago, had a Bozo the Clown. You'd punch that Bozo. Blah, 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 right? That's where you want to be. Here comes an inflicted statement. Wow. Okay. Right here. There's another one. Whoa. I'm back. That's the position that you want to be in, whether you're sitting or not. I'm neutral. So you're not affecting me. And I'm thinking clearly. So there are a couple that I have.
Thank you. You know what I love about that? Well done, Alice. And Alice, aren't you doing a workshop later on today?
I am.
Body language? Great. That was great. And you know, I would say, I think that would come in handy all the time. But think about when you have a difficult boss, being able to really be able to regain yourself can be really a really great tip. All right, so let me go to, how many of you want to learn how to manage your boss's boss? All right. Yeah. So although that's not technically managing up front line, first line, it is managing up second line. So I'd like to ask the panelists, like, how to do that. Some of it's networking, but some of it's really managing up. So I'm going to start with Chrissy, because you work in a big company, right?
I do.
And so tell us, like, what is your advice? How do you manage up to your boss's boss? What are your tips for developing those relationships and gaining visibility with the higher-ups?
Two things, and both from Rackspace and my Bain experience, but I would say make a plan with your current boss. I think going around your current boss to go and manage up and get your visibility with the boss's boss doesn't go well if you're doing it without your current boss. So make sure you have a plan with them, carve out the time and the space to have roles and responsibilities within that meeting space. The second thing, in
specific meetings, you want to carve out roles.
Ideally, the best meetings are great when you actually have time, which never happens, by the way. But if you have time beforehand to say, hey, in this meeting with these level executives, I'm going to present about this, or like whenever a question comes up about why, I will jump in. And those meetings, especially with client meetings, it was always best practice to have a full team powwow beforehand so that even the first-year associate consultant out of school knew when to jump in on the data so they weren't just a body in the room. Or maybe they are just a body in the room for that one meeting. You should carve out that role.
I love that. How many of you have ever done that, talked about the meeting with your boss before you went to find out your role? How many of you are kind of scared to do that? All right, good. Oh, yeah, but thank you for that. But, yeah, I think that's really great. So meetings, anything else you'd recommend about getting that visibility?
A second thing, I think, is to really own your piece. So to make sure that you have ownership over whatever project that is and show your current boss, again, that you add value and that you are going to a level, one, that is appropriate for your boss's boss, and then, two, to a level that your boss probably can't go to. So to bring the level of insights to the right level, And to a place where you are actually adding value, because then that's probably one of his priorities. He wants to look good in front of his boss, and he wants to make sure that the insights are unique. So you should try to do that.
And Laura, you used to work for big corporations. Anything you would add?
Yeah, that was all really great advice. I also think nobody ever gets fired for going slow and asking for clarification. So if you rush through relationships or you make assumptions about behaviors, about needs and preferences, you're going to get yourself in trouble. So make a plan and also ask a lot of clarifying questions. And the one question that I love is, how did what I just say make you feel? So when you have a question for your boss or your boss's boss, go slow, ask about feelings, and make sure you're still trotting on the same path. That's what I would recommend.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, Laura, I'm coming back to you. How do you, because you're HR, you know, you got all the HR stuff.
I can't quit it, clearly.
I can't. Yeah, no. Every time she gets out, how do you manage disagreement or conflict with your boss?
Oh, my goodness. That is a PhD thesis, right? How do you manage conflict with your spouse? How do you manage conflict with your partner, right? If you are the chief relationship officer of your life, managing conflict is rooted in salesmanship skills and negotiation skills. So how many of you have taken a salesmanship class, sales class? Yeah, those are the skills that you'll need in order to manage relationships. And how about negotiation courses? Who's taken a negotiation course? If you haven't, put that in your personal development plan for 2019. Those skills are so useful, because when you have a relationship, it's all about compromise. And I am someone who believes in the Obama doctrine, that if two people have conflict and they come together and they're both a little unhappy, that's probably okay, you know? So again, salesmanship skills, negotiation skills, and that's what's going to get you through those contentious conversations.
And what if you make a really bad mistake?
Yeah.
How do you manage that? How many of you made a really like, uh-oh, SpaghettiO? Yeah. How would you recommend handling that?
How would I recommend handling that? Full and complete ownership, being a healthy adult, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Nobody in your corporation is going to solve your relationship problems for you. There is no HR representative who is going to swoop in and be your counselor or be your therapist or be your advisor. And that's because HR has its own set of problems. They are employees just like you. They have political issues just like you. And they don't know what the hell they're doing, right? I mean, we're all in this life together trying to figure it out. Truly, we are all human beings striving to be healthy adults. And so taking ownership when you make a mistake, being an adult, and also coming to it with a solution is the best way to do it. I believe in something called a pre-mortem, actually. I love to envision, because I'm a weirdo, how things are going to fail before they fail, and make a plan to avoid failure. This is a cognitive trick that has saved my hide since 1995. So if you are in a contentious situation with your supervisor, you have problems with a colleague, there's conflict around you, imagine the worst case scenario. You're fired, you're humiliated, you're poor, you're broke. And then work backwards and make a plan to avoid that from happening. The pre-mortem is the one thing you should walk out of here curious about, passionate about, and learn about it.
Thank you. Christy, as a boss, when someone makes a terrible mistake, what does owning it look like to you?
That's a good question. Two things. One, owning it. What do we do now?
Like, so the owning number it means one thing, I did this,
exactly articulating what is the mistake. Two, where do we go from here? Don't come with a mistake and then not have a recommendation. And I was actually, I thought you were going to a different question, which is, as a boss, how do you then own it to your boss? Because I always feel like it's very important to, with the team, like, you made a mistake, but we made a mistake. So owning it as a boss to your then boss and taking ownership for your team, because it wasn't one person. That person didn't make one. Oftentimes, it's not one person who made that mistake. It goes through a lot of filters and a lot of places to get to where you made that mistake. So owning it for your team, as for all the bosses in the room, too, I'm sure it's best practice to try to do that.
And so, Alice, when we're owning a mistake with our boss, what's our body language need to be?
Neutral.
And how apologetic should we be?
I would be clear. I would say the fact. I would take responsibility, and I would let it go.
Yeah. And as women, I think we have a habit of saying, I'm sorry. You know what? After a while, you're just going to annoy your boss, right? So say you're sorry, exactly like that, and then let it go and let them let it go.
Because there is an apologetic body.
Yeah, show us.
Nice.
And I say one more thing on this. I love this. So I put my foot in my mouth all the time. Believe me. Like, I am the queen of the mea culpa. Like, and with someone on my team, like, they do something wrong or a client gets mad, I'm like, I'll go apologize. And I don't do it out of a place of weakness. I think it's a place of strength. To really learn how to make a good, solid apology without becoming like, But when you own something, by the way, and when you're the first one to say, like, oh, I did that wrong, I fucked it up, no one's going to beat you up for it. Because you already beat yourself up for it. So then they'll let you go. So that's just my mea culpa spiel. I'm really... And by the way, I'll do this for anybody. You guys need an apology made, call me up. I'll come do it for you. I'm really good at it. Let me go to Christy. Back to Christy. If you're focused on your own success, right? Because we all should be as our teams. How do you have a conversation about your development when your boss's other priorities and focus? In other words, how do you get your boss to focus on having a developmental conversation with you?
Okay, two things. One is try to frame it in terms of those intrinsic drivers or the values and the things that they are going for.
Can you give us an example of a driver and how you might frame it?
Yes. A driver. So I feel like there's both personal goals and business goals. So if the business goal is revenue, bringing them a development that says, look, if I get in front of more customers and I need the ability to do that, I can drive more revenue, but right now I don't have that experience. So, like, let me be in front of the top 10 customers more so. That's a business driver. I feel like the personal drivers are, one could be like his perception of his boss to himself. So what are things that he's working on and how can you help him develop those? So if he's working on presentation skills for his boss, or, like, you know, getting down deep into the data because he doesn't always prove that he has the level of analytics, help him to do that. But then you can also practice, you know, you're working on visibility with your boss's boss. So you can get there. Both of your goals are aligned. I want visibility with my boss's boss. He needs to show that he can be expert on the data. We can both combine our synergies together so that we're both working toward our goals.
How many of you think it's your boss's job to have a developmental conversation with you? Raise your hand. Every one of you should be raising your hand. It is absolutely your boss's responsibility to proactively have developmental conversations with you. How many of your bosses actually do have those conversations with you proactively? Right? And everybody else should be raising their hand. So if they are not, then you have to drive that. So Christy talked a little bit about what you want to do in that. Lori, just give us the basics. Like, what does that mean? It means what? It means calling them, scheduling it.
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, please, because you're right on the money. But I think there's something that we do in our careers that's so toxic. We wait for the end of the year, and we wait for our managers to come to us and tell us what we should be doing, how we did, and how much of it's usually 3.8% merit increase, right? So we get a merit increase, and we sit there, and we're like, okay, we're so fundamentally disappointed. Or we try to be proactive, and we schedule this meeting, but we schedule it at year end, or at the end of the quarter, or at a really busy time. So this is about relationship management, calendar management, and being savvy enough, and to your points earlier, knowing your boss, and getting on their schedule, and bringing about your conversation around development, but tying it into the business. And I don't fundamentally believe that it's any boss's responsibility to be in charge of your development and have a development conversation. I believe it's your responsibility to own your career. And if your boss isn't doing it, oh, well, they're not there to self-actualize you anyway. You're in life to self-actualize yourself. So take it upon yourself. If you want to have that conversation, have it. Just time it properly.
I love that. Anything to add on that else?
Well, I love everything you're saying, and it's what I would have to say is whatever happens mentally, physically needs to be in congruency. If they're not in congruency, you're noticed and it's picked up. And so if I'm confident about something, yeah, I need to look and sound confident, like I know what I'm talking about. If it's important that this project or whatever we're doing is something that others might listen to and be motivated to change, then I need to show that. I need to I also need to be excited about it in vocally and physically. So it needs to be congruent. That's really where I'm coming from.
I love that. Ladies, let me ask you guys, how many of you have multiple bosses? What kind of fun hell is that, right? It can be very difficult. How many of you sometimes get caught between the multiple bosses? One wants one wants another. Awesome. Ladies, starting with Christy, how do we manage this? This is the number two question I get, is how to manage multiple two bosses. The first one is micromanagers, which we'll talk about, but go ahead.
It's not easy. I'll just say that. I mean, it's hard. I think you have to do all the things that you would do with your regular current boss and do that across the entire board. So you have to, okay, I'm going into a meeting with this person and this partner acts this way, this C-level person acts this way. So trying to always change yourself to adapt. And like I said before, it's not easy. But I think the more you interact with that person, the more you are adapting on a constant, literally constant, minute-by-minute basis, you get better at it. But, I mean, I'm no expert. It's hard.
Yeah. I know. It's very hard. And, Lori, what if the two bosses have different points of view on something?
Good.
You're caught in the middle. What do you do?
Well, and not only if the two bosses have different points of view, but maybe one boss isn't really your boss. It's a customer, but they act like your boss. I mean, there are all kinds of conflicting issues here. And I think my point that I made earlier stands. Go slow, set expectations, and ask, how does this make you feel? Like, ask those questions about feelings, because you're going to elicit a ton of cues, a ton of responses to help you write a roadmap going forward. And again, you know, we're all in this work environment where we're push. Pushing is going to get you fired. Making assumptions is going to get you fired. Slow down, ask clarifying questions, and you know what? This is the HR lady in me. Document everything, right? Keep a little journal, keep bullet points. And if you have any questions, if you feel like you're in the crosshairs, seek out advice from a mentor, a friend, a colleague, or go back to those bosses and ask those clarifying questions. But again, slow down. That's my advice to you.
And I would add, you know, you have to be brave sometimes. We got to put on our big girl pants sometimes and say, hey, boss A, you want this? In a nicer tone than mine. Hey, boss A, you want this. Boss B, you want this. Help me understand which way we want to go with this project. A lot of times, we assume they know that they're giving us contradicting, but they don't. So don't assume they know. Raise it. Get them in the same room if you can. But really, like, raise that point, I would say, also. All right, we're going to do a couple more, and then we're going to have lots of time for Q&A. You guys have lots of questions? Because you want to talk about specific? Okay. So let me say this. I'm going to start with Lori. So we have, let's say I have a terrible boss. Terrible boss. Yes. She or he is just a living nightmare. How can or cannot HR help me? And when do I know whether it's safe to go to HR?
Wait, am I telling truths?
Yes, you're telling truths. This is truth bomb. Absolutely.
All right. So you are primarily responsible for solving your conflict in the workplace. Human resources, as you know, I mean, we've just had a year and a half of Me Too. Come on up, right? HR is there to protect the interest of the organization. HR is not your advocate. They're not your stewards. They're not your friends. And I am so sorry, because when I worked in human resources, I wanted to be your advocate. I wanted to be your steward. I wanted to be your friend. And that's why I no longer work there, right? I cannot do that work in human resources. So the way that you can get through really contentious situations is by being radically transparent with your friends at work and your colleagues and asking for advice and seeking out help. There is strength in numbers. There is also strength on Glassdoor. There's strength in anonymous Twitter accounts. There's strength in anonymous blogging. There are ways to motivate your company. But before you blow it up and try to seek a resolution in the public eye, start with your friend group. Start with your community at work. And if you don't have a community at work, try to find your people, whether that's online or at a local networking event. But ask for help, because HR is, like, they're nice men and women. They really love their work, and they really want to help out. And oftentimes, they are conflicted, but they're not there for you. Yeah. That's it.
And I would also add, know the history of your HR department, right? Right. Know whether or not they have, stuck up for you or gone out, or whether or not they are just pawns of the.
Yes, I think that's really important. But you should know that human resources has one of the highest turnover rates of any department in any company. So even if your HR department has a history of standing up for you, 36 months ago is a decade ago. Right. Leadership changes so quickly in that function. So again, I love that piece of advice. Know who's in your human resources department, but their fundamental motivation is to make sure that the organization is indemnified against lawsuits. So when you start down the path of human resources, you are inviting a lot of questions that you may, frankly, not want to invite into your life. So start with your friend group, start with mentors, start with advisors. That's where I would go for first level advice.
How many of you are in HR? Anybody in HR in this room? Yeah, does anything, does that sound right to you? No?
I know,
great. So
I know
what's doesn't. Your truth?
Yeah, I think it really depends on the company that you work for and the value system that they have. So I've really had a great opportunity to work with both HEB and Accenture, and I Rackspace, and their values are so much towards just the people development. And any time where we have had questions that really kind of blurred the lines of ethics, I really had strong, powerful leaders in both organizations really stand behind us to help affect change.
That's great. So that's great. Good for
story.
Rackspace.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, and you're both really right. I mean, that's why you want to check, because there are a few, and I'll call them more unicorn organizations like Rackspace that will do that. But so many really, really are what Lori's talking about. They're just there to indemnify. And really, usually the smaller they are. How many people work for government? I mean, if you work for government and you're in HR in government, keep your hand up.
Why would you do that?
Because I'm about to tell you the truth about HR government. I work a lot. I live in D.C., right? So I work a lot in the federal government. They're, you know, you're in D.C. They're in your neighborhood. You're going to use them
HR
as clients, and they spend a lot
fire.
Of money. And you know where their HR, their HR people? From all the organizations, departments where they don't know what to do with them. They put them into the HR department. So if you work for a federal
government.
That's federal government.
No, that's not.
So if you work for the federal government, that happens a lot. So just know that. All right. We're going to do one more, and then we're going to get a lot of questions. Let me start with what are your top three tips for managing up? The top three things you think people need to do.
I go first?
Please.
One, know their drivers, which we talked about, both, I think, business and personal. Two, there's a handful of no-brainer things that you should do. My biggest one is always concise, structured communication, like emails or when you're speaking, like, write the key takeaways at the top. Use selective bolding if people at your company don't think it's rude.
And why is that important?
Why is that important? I think to leverage your supervisor's time. I don't know, depending, whatever style they are, I don't know a supervisor who doesn't get over 100 emails a day, who doesn't want to be able to read your email on his phone or her phone, three lines, three words, and know exactly what they need to know from that email. I don't know who doesn't want their time to be efficiently used via communication. My third tip, though, was I think you're, this is a shameless plug for your book.
Thank you, baby. Wait.
It's chapter 22. Yeah, do the Vanna White. Chapter 22 has literally 50 tips. I think I listened to that chapter probably at least like 5 times just before coming here, because they're all so useful. It's 50 tips, and you just, there's a lot, though. So it's hard to do them all. But if you just try to do at least a handful of them, like, you're probably doing better than you were yesterday.
And what's the one best thing you ever did when you managed up?
I mean, the communication thing, I feel like that is one thing Bain has formal training on, like how to write an email. So I'd like to think that my emails, despite all the detail down below, I usually try to use bolding and a few bullet points at the top, one or two, where you can get the information you need.
Would you come work for me if my team did that? I would love you so much. All right, Miss Lori.
Well, I mean, all great advice up here. I think the three things I would recommend is remember that you are the chief relationship officer. You are not your job. You're a human being. I think the second thing is that conflict is inevitable, so plan for it. So use the premortem to your advantage. And number three, know your boundaries. While work is hierarchical and it's matrixed, there's only so much nonsense that you can take in your life and still be a healthy human being. So know your boundaries, know your values, and know when to walk away. Stop investing in a job that's eating you up from the inside.
I love that. And what's the one tip when you were working for the corporate world, for the man, what's the one thing that you did to manage up that you were most proud of?
I didn't. I screwed it up all the time. You know, I think one of the things I wish I would have done is I wish I would have listened more than talk. But I was one of those eager beavers who really wanted to have this corporate career. And boy, I wanted all the answers, and I wanted my bosses to love me, and I wanted to just impress the hell out of them. And I did the opposite. And so I really regret that. I should have shut up more. Yeah. That's great.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And Miss Alice, what are your top three tips for managing up?
First is develop your own style in communication and know what it is. Two, be able to gradate it depending on the person. You don't want to lose your style because then you're a chameleon. Keep your style, gradate it. This person's more formal. This person's bitchy. This person's slow. This person's fast.
I'm going to make me.
I'm going to make that adjustment. And the other thing is, when you are in doubt about how the connection is going, and you don't know, you're not aware of it, try looking at the person. Make eye contact. You'll learn so much. They're my three.
I love it. And what's the one thing you've done to manage up that you're most proud of?
So I had a boss that completely ignored me and most of the women in the office. He just, you know, he'd breeze past you. He wouldn't look at you. So what I learned to do with him, and this one did work, I would watch when he got emotional about something, either on the phone or in some kind of communication he was having, and I went, okay, that's my spot to move in to have some connection with him. And I found out that it worked.
So what did you do? Like
he might be on the phone and he's, you know, I could hear he just... So I'd wait a minute and I'd say, his name wasn't Bill, I'd say, hey, Bill, okay? Everything all right? Because I read that. That's that observing I was talking about. Or an expression on his face, you know, like inside he's saying shit, but he doesn't say it out loud, right.
I love it.
Then I go in and I'd say, hey,
you know what I love?
Have lunch?
You know what I love about that is that's counterintuitive, right? You would think if someone looks annoying, I'm like, I'm going to stay away from that. But you use that as a door.
A doorway.
Clever, clever, yeah. Mr. Bond. I'm going to give mine because it's my question. I get to answer it, right? Mine would be like, go have the conversation. Go ask your boss, what are your preferences? How do you like to work? What are your priorities? What's important to you? This is my favorite question. What are your pet peeves, right? You might be doing something that's driving your boss cray-cray and not even know it. And then the last question that you want to ask them is, what can I do, because I'm not changing you, what can I do more of, less of, or differently? And really listen to what they say, and chances are they will turn around and have that conversation with you. Who are my bosses? Raise your hand. How many of you have had someone come in and have that conversation with you? Keep your hand up. How did it work? Did you like it? Did it make a good relationship? Did you love that person a little bit more than the other person that didn't? Probably, right? Hopefully. Or maybe not. So go have the conversation.
I love it. Thank you. Let's give a round of applause for the panel. Lovely. So we are going to open it up for Q&A. If you have a question, you can start making your way toward the mics. But before we open those up, I have a question of my own, because we always like the juicy stuff. So if all or any of you want to share your worst boss and how you handled it, I'm sure that question will come up.
My worst boss was an elected official. We'll call him Dave Clark because that was his name. not going to lie. Washington, D.C., there's a law school named after him. He's dead, so it's okay. He was a bully, screaming shouter. He would be in conversation, and he would just all of a sudden just start screaming at you. And then he would do this. He would turn to the wall and go,
what?
I don't know, some cray-cray thing. I literally said, that was after I had a series of difficult bosses. I said, you know what? I don't need to work for assholes anymore. I can be my own asshole. And I quit. I know, it's serious. I quit, and I opened up my first business, which was a bar and a nightclub. But that's what I did. You cannot work for crazy.
I think I did mine.
Yes.
Yep.
Yep.
So I went on an interview at a Fortune 100 pharmaceutical company, and the head of human resources looked me in the face and said, I really want to make you an offer. I think you're going to love working for me. You're going to love it here, but I have to tell you something. If you ever screw up and don't tell me about it, I'm going to rip your head off and shit down your throat. Wow. And I said, how much are you going to offer me?
Wow.
And I took the job. It was a lot of money. So
was he a nightmare?
Hopefully never made a mistake.
I never made a mistake. Yeah. Well, and I'm not in human resources anymore, so it all worked out. But yeah. It's amazing what you do to pay off your student loans.
I can't follow that.
It's a tough one.
Mine, I mean, a Yeller combination, Yeller and Siegel. Like, swoop in right before the Steerco. What's going on? What's going on? And I'll yell about it. That was really terrible.
Oh, that's horrible.
So seagulls, there's two kinds. Like the ones that swoop and poop, like, right? And then swoop away. And then there's the seagulls that swoop and steal. Like a project worker kind of swoop away.
Oh, yeah. That's good. This one was a pooper. Mega pooper.
Oh, that's funny.
We'll start right here, and then we'll toggle back and forth.
Yeah. A little bit. Can everyone else hear?
That one's
Here we go.
Try that.
Try it again.
No.
We'll repeat
keep
it.
Working on that.
Yeah, we.
Well, go ahead and yell your question, and I'll repeat it.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So my question is for body language, and all my team and my managers work remotely, so we do frequent video conferences, but it's from here to here. What do I look for?
That's such a good question.
Can we repeat the question so everyone can hear it?
What's your name?
Margaret.
Margaret's team does most of what they do virtually, and it's very hard to see facial expressions. Can you see them at all?
Yes, but they're very small because the camera's here and they're like where you are.
Well, you know, one thing I'd say is in those kind of conferences, the voice is also important. So it's physically, there's 10,000 facial expressions. How many do you use? Seriously, we limit ourselves. But what I'd say is you try to observe the face, but more than that, you can actually get a lot of information from the modulation of the voice, the tone of the voice, if the voice is very low, if it's very slow, if it's very fast. They're more the ways that you can read. It's very hard to read tiny facial expressions.
I have a book recommendation for you if you'd like it. It's brand new. I just reviewed it. It's called Can You Hear Me? By Dr. Nick Morgan, and it's published by Harvard Business Press. And he has a chapter on virtual communications for conference calls and webinars. And he advises that you do a meeting or a video before the meeting, and you try to humanize one another. So maybe you do a video in the office. You show what it's like to celebrate within some cultural event, whatever it is. But you start to make human-to-human connections outside of that virtual meeting so that when you come to the virtual meeting, you have a sense of personalities, preferences, and ideas. So Can You Hear Me Now would be a really great resource for you.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah,
I'll take a look at it.
Hi, so can you hear me?
Yeah.
So, Christy, you mentioned that we need to find out what our bosses care about personally sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I know I'm probably stereotyping a little bit here, but a lot of male bosses tend to be less personal. They tend to offer up less about their family or, you know, their loved ones. So how do you make the connection with the male boss to find out what motivates him personally?
Yeah, it's a good question. Let me clarify. When I said personal drivers, I think I meant more like personal professional development drivers. So, like, what are they working on? What makes them tick? Like, do they like presenting for the whole time? It's very tactical. Do you like presenting the whole time in front of their boss, therefore your boss's boss? Or are they okay with kind of like spreading love around the room? In terms of the personal relationship, though, I feel like there's a fair share of men, I think, who are actually emotive and who like to talk about their personal life. They're extremely extroverted, like myself. But I feel like the ones that are more introverted and more private, you can still build a relationship, but you can make it more about work. Ask them how that meeting went. I feel like building relationships is so important, but ask them about meetings. Ask them about work politics or projects or things that are surrounded around work. And maybe they don't want to talk about their family. You don't waltz in always telling them, like, oh, my weekend was great. How was yours? And you give them the play-by-play. Like, some of them don't want to hear that. So make sure you read that and don't talk about it. But I feel like there's definitely ways to build personal relationships that actually don't involve any talk about your personal life. Yeah, that makes sense.
That's great.
Hi, nice to meet you. I'm Maura Abramovic. I'm working at VMware, sister company to Pivotal.
So you do know what I did.
I'm doing IT for strategic sourcing for IT. So I work with a lot of engineers on one hand and managers on the other hand. And my job is basically to challenge my stakeholders when I'm not technical and I need to challenge them and ask questions. And sometimes my managers say things, you know, without figuring out it's not going to work. So how do you challenge your manager? How do you do it remotely when you open video and they don't? And how do you make them open video when they just don't?
So I'm going to take that one. That's okay. So you, this is where, as Chrissy says, it's really important to know the personality of your manager. So if your role is to challenge them or to ask a lot of questions, understand that the impact potentially, not your intention, the impact potentially is that you are questioning them, right? You probably got that. So you have to find a way, you have to preface why you are asking the question. You would let them know you are going to be asking them these questions, and you're going to have to tell them why you need them. So it might look like something like, I love this idea, and you know we need to think about this. So here are some of the things. I might do this in writing if they're engineering types ahead of time. Here are some of the things that we need to explore, and here's some of the questions I'm going to be asking. Like, I would really foreshadow the what you're asking them and the why you're asking them. That would be my advice. I don't know, Chrissy, you're in with engineering types.
I think that's a great point, is putting things down in writing. I also think, and this is probably more from my consulting days than it is from Rackspace, but honestly, it stinks. A lot of times you have to use hedgy words, like, it seems like you want to do XYZ. Or from what I'm hearing is something, and it sounds sometimes too qualifying or too hedgy. It's the way a lot of times we talk to our clients. It's because you want to tell them, like, I'm challenging you, but I don't want to be really mean about it or tell you that, like, you're dumb or not saying the right thing. And so you have to use those hedgy qualifying words, or, like, a short one that I like to use that doesn't sound really long-winded is, like, just to play devil's advocate.
Yeah, it's very short. And here's a phrase for you. Remember it. Write it down, stone. Use the phrase yes and.
I like that part.
It's magic. The minute you say yes but to somebody, you have completely butted them. If you need to butt someone, butt them, right? Butt them. But say yes and this perspective as well. They will not feel dismissed. Good luck.
Thank you. And thank you for the...
Hi, so I have a question for you. What if you are in a company that never has professional development, say government, and everyone's there just to retire? How do you have discussion with your boss of, like, there's no professional development track? There's no room to, like, move up in management. So do you have any tips?
I have a tip. Go find a job that's more consistent with your values where you can have an opportunity to grow and develop, right?
Second part is, what if you're a recent grad and this is a great stepping stone, but now you have a new manager who's not letting you have experiences and you're kind of stuck?
Yes, you are stuck, and part of that is where you are in your career. So take the opportunity for the next 18 to 24 months in this role to understand that you're stuck and to find development opportunities elsewhere. And you're going to have to be okay with that, because your company is saying the government is saying the terms and condition of your employment is that we're not going to develop you. But there are probably other things that are good about your job. So revel in that, enjoy that, and look for development opportunities, whether it's with Junior League or the Optimist Club or Rotary or wherever you can find leadership opportunities elsewhere. Does that make your day longer? Absolutely. Is it unfair and does it suck? Absolutely. You should have a boss who loves you and wants you to excel in the world. But the good thing is that when you get a little bit older and you take on that next role, you're going to be different. You're going to be a different leader with a different philosophy because of the experience you're having now. This is changing you. This is changing the future of work. And so I hope you stay close to this memory of how much it sucks. And when people start reporting to you, you learn from it and you help pull them up through their career. And I'm sorry, that's not great. I know.
No, but go find a mentor. Go. It doesn't have to be your boss. There's going to be someone in this organization or another organization or many people. And go have coffee. Go have lunch. You know what we old people love to do? We love to talk about ourselves. Go ask them, like, tell me about your career. How did you get there? Get them talking about you. Say, what advice do you have for me? I'm really liking this. I'm not sure. Build a little relationship. Find some other experts, mentors, who can at least give you a little guidance.
And one more thing. You can go to Toastmasters.
Practice
talking in front of people.
Yeah. That's absolutely excellent advice, yes.
Cool. Thank you.
I'm so sorry.
It's real.
Hi. Number one, Mary, oh, my God, your shoes.
just for you ladies, I broke out the flu bugs.
Awesome. So great. You almost touched on it earlier, but we didn't get there, micromanagers.
Mm. You're talking about micromanagers?
And so, yeah, and specifically micromanagers that may not be in the same location as you, that they're on the West Coast. So you did talk a little bit about how to deal with...
Yeah.
Kind of a co-located boss or somebody that's not necessarily in around
all right,
you all
so
the time.
I'm going to give you the lowdown on the micromanager. How many people have had a micromanager? How many people hated that? How many of you are a micromanager? Come on, be honest. How many of you
three
have
honest
micromanaged before? We've all done it. So the first thing, the micromanagers, they're actually really the number one boss that people hate the most. And this is because as human beings, we have what's called the neuropsychological need for autonomy, right? Mm-hmm. And we also have a neuropsychological need for certainty. And when your boss's neuropsychological need for certainty is greater than your need for autonomy, right? And it feels like micromanaging. Micromanagers need three things: information, inclusion, and control. The more you resist giving that to them, the more they are going to hold the reins. You need to find out, first of all, don't take it personally unless you're the only one being micromanaged. Then you need to take it really personally, right? Because you're not doing something. You need to find out what it is they want. My people who micromanage, when you micromanage, why are you doing it?
Trust.
Because of the problem, there's trust, there's things need to be done a certain way. You need to go find out what the micromanager wants, how she wants it done, when she wants it done. You got to check in. Then you have to make sure you are giving her or him lots of proactive information. Flood them with information. Give them the answers before they have it. Think about proactively what they're going to ask for and what they need and provide it. Show that you are going to deliver the quality product that they think every time. After a while, 90% of them are going to let go of the reins. The 10 that don't are the control freaks that you just have to then... That can become the truly terrible. But that's my thing. But what happens is we resist the micromanager. Is it wrong? Yes. Is it not fair? Yes. Are we going to change them?
No.
No. Does that help? Who's my micromanager question?
Yeah. Over here.
And because you asked about my favorite boss, this is for you.
Oh, wow. Oh. Excellent.
You're welcome. Oh, you were? We'll give it back. Okay.
Hi, my name's Evelyn. This is from an experience I went through a couple of years ago that I reflect back on often. When you work at a company you like, you have a job that you like, you have a boss that you like, and you've made a mistake, and you've owned up to it, but you can tell that your relationship with that boss is now fractured. Yeah. There's like an underlying a mistrust. They're not going to give you the same projects or whatever that you had before. What do you watch for? What indicators do you look for when deciding whether to rebuild that relationship or cut your losses and move on?
What do you guys think?
Well, I think there are three components. One is, historically, do you know anybody who has made a mistake that you can talk to, that you can tap into and seek their advice within the company? I think it would be good to get some information from your colleagues, your coworkers, your friends. I think Alice can speak to this, but you're going to want to read your boss's body language like a hawk and figure out what's really going on. But I also think you're going to want to listen to the words that are being said to you, because there are some words that tell you your career is over. You know, words when they're saying no, when they're hedging their language. So really listen to what's being said to you, because oftentimes the message is pretty clear and there is no rebuilding and you're being told, and yet, for some reason, we hold on to this last vestige of hope, right? We're like, oh, if we could just prove them wrong, and there's no proving them wrong. And that's the horrible part about adulthood. They're in power, right? They're not going to let go. They're not going to give you a second chance. So sometimes it's really about just having those tough conversations with yourself as well. But I don't know, Alice, what do you think?
Well, I love this, the idea of observing. So I'm going to put out a nuts idea, and I don't know if you're going to agree with this, but I'm ready to leave. So I'm going to ask, did I damage, did I crack something? I wouldn't necessarily use those poetic words, but did I crack the vase? You know, it's, you know, this seems to me that this has affected our working relationship. Is there anything I can do?
That's excellent.
Yeah.
I don't know. What do you think?
Exactly what I would do. And if they say, no, we're fine,
they're That's lying.
I can say from my own experience, ask those questions sooner rather than later.
Yes.
Don't wait a year.
Thank you for sharing that story.
Yeah. And you know the old customer service adage, for one bad interaction, it takes 13 to make it up. So if you feel like you've done 13 interactions and they're still holding it against you, have the conversation.
Okay, over here.
Hi, so I'm an extrovert, like to talk and share my ideas. I've worked really hard in my career to find the moments to stop and listen more and not have to always be speaking or sharing my ideas. But then there are times where I leave a meeting and I think, well, wow, maybe I didn't add value because I didn't speak up. So I'm just wondering, maybe are there times when you just need to know you need to speak? And then are there other, like, body language things that maybe I could get some of my points across without having to be talking?
I'm going to just address it and then I'm going to give it to her. So introversion and extroversion is a really important thing to know in the workplace, right? Because if your boss is offshore than you, chances are you're going to be driving them cray-cray, right? So I would say for extroverts, just in my basic experience, I don't think it's about not speaking. I think extroverts have a tendency not to be succinct or to think out loud. So if you're in a room full of introverts, don't think out loud and be a little bit more succinct. Like, think about what you're going to say. Extroverts, I don't know, y'all love to do all that.
I work with a lot of extroverts. Yeah. So there's a lot of talking in the room. And I think that's it. Sometimes it's like you want to get a word in edgewise, but at the same time, you don't want to be looked at, or I wanted to make sure I wasn't being looked at as the person who just is always, like,
You can also do, you can be the person that summarizes. So here's what I've heard from everybody, X, Y, Z. Here's my take. And be succinct. I'm going to be like, oh, she's so smart.
I just am noticing, this lovely expression you have. And I call that painting a picture. But you need a little Sharpie in there. If you're painting a picture, like a little more defined movement. But the other thing is, this is a metaphor I like to use, is that's a beautiful river. It needs some banks. So that means, because otherwise it's just going to flow all over the place. So it needs to come in a little bit, which might be, I like this, pausing, not speaking all the time, being succinct, and then being aware of this, because you're in a group that everybody's doing this, right?
And I talk with my hands, too. So a lot of, like, this, because I'm aware of, like, some of those things. But
do you know what I mean by a Sharpie? A Sharpie, when you're doing, it's a little more precise.
Yes.
And you can do that with movement, actually, because you can be, here I am painting a picture. And now I'm getting a little more
to the point.
Precise.
Thank you.
Almost right at time. I think we can take this one more over here.
Okay. So how do you deal with a boss or communicate with a boss that interacts with you in a way that they feel you should have to go through their same challenges? So a recent example is, it took me 2 years to get this resource, so don't expect any better than what I've done, rather than try to figure out a better way. That doesn't make it right. But how do I express myself and communicate to a person who is interacting in that manner?
So your boss just told you exactly what he or she wants from you. Your boss just told you exactly what the road to success is for him or her with you.
Okay.
So you either have to take for granted what they just told you, right? Mm-hmm. Or you have to slowly try to change them and making requests. I don't know, Christy, Lori, what do you guys think?
I was going to say the latter. It's funny. If that is what it is, then I think, one, can you change it? Two, are you okay if that is the kind of minimum viable path? Because if that's what it is, then, and you're okay with that, then find the best way to accelerate or to find your happiness point on that 2-year journey that he's just expecting. Because sometimes it is tenure based and you can't change that in that specific organization. I think to Mary's point, you could try to change it. Try.
So my life's work is fixing work. This is something I've discovered. And I think we fix work by fixing ourselves. And that is a complicated answer. But for you, you may have to endure these 2 years. But as I said to the other individual who was up here before, when you become a leader, and you must become a leader, these lessons that you've learned have got to guide you to lead in a different way. That 2-year arbitrary rule, the paying your dues, the showing up but being quiet in a meeting because you're a millennial, all that garbage has to go, And every single person in the room is accountable for changing that. And I believe that while this experience is awful, it's also formative, and it's going to make you a better leader. So use it and drive further in your career. Get promoted, make a ton of money, change the workforce. I believe in you, if that means anything to you. You can do it.
What an excellent point to end on. Round of applause again for this wonderful panel. Thank you all for joining us.